today on Against the Grain.
People always thought that we're trying to get oil before, but really the main goal of regime change for the 21st century, and it included all the presidents that we've had, was really because Venezuela had power as an oil producer. At one point, they were giving more foreign aid to Latin America than the United States, with an economy just a fraction of the size. You had all these countries that had left governments. It was the majority of the region governed by left governments.
As Congress considers a war powers vote, economist Mark Weisbrot places the Trump administration's attack on Venezuela in the context of a long-standing bipartisan campaign to undermine left-leaning governments across Latin America. He discusses the differing visions Trump and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, have for the region, one focused on oil and the other on regime change, including in Cuba. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Is Trump's intervention into Venezuela, promising as he has to run the country and open up its petroleum reserves to American companies, is it simply about oil? Chevron, for example, has operated in Venezuela for years, including under the Maduro government. Or should the attack be viewed as part of an effort to remove Venezuela's ability to bolster left-leaning governments in the region, from the so-called pink tide to the present? Mark Weisbrot is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and has written about Venezuela for over 25 years. Mark, what is the legality of the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the capture of its president, Nicolas Maduro? In terms of U.S. law and international law, was the U.S. within its rights to do this?
It's completely illegal what they did under so many laws and treaties. First of all, under the Charter of the United Nations, well, even the blockade is a violation of it's armed conflict, basically, and it's illegal armed conflict. But the all the other stuff that they've done, the military actions, the kidnapping of the president, all of that is illegal under the Charter of the Organization of American States, under the UN Charter, under international law, and under U.S. law itself, partly because, according to our Constitution, when we sign a treaty, that becomes legally binding on the United States as well.
Can you describe also, we'll talk more about the attack and its aftermath, but I wonder if you could also describe the U.S. government's blockade of Venezuela and the legality of that, because, of course, the leverage that the U.S. is mounting against Venezuela is not just based on whatever took place on, January 3rd, but is part of a larger dynamic of coercion and intimidation.
Yes, well, there's no doubt about it, and they've said that out loud, that they've got leverage, and Trump accurately calls it a blockade, and that is, again, that's illegal. That's illegal armed conflict, according to the UN, to use a blockade. And this is a very important point, because this is really what destroyed the Venezuelan economy. This is something that most people here don't know. It was sanctions against Venezuela, and one of the most powerful and damaging sanctions that was implemented under Trump in his first term was to cut off Venezuela from its oil exports, because that's 90% of their foreign currency earnings. And all countries need foreign currency, just about all, well, not the United States, but everybody else needs foreign currency earnings because it's a dollar-based financial system. And so, and for Venezuela, they're even more dependent on imports for their economy than most countries. So, and then there's food and medicines and infrastructure for the water system, and all of these things were cut off to varying degrees, but hugely from the Venezuelan economy. And so what they're doing with the blockade is just what they did with the sanctions that destroyed the Venezuelan economy from 2012 to 2020. The Venezuelan economy lost 3/4 of its economic output and therefore income. That is the 3 times, imagine the Great Depression in the United States, how terrible it was. You multiply that by 3, and that's what Venezuela has suffered through. And you don't ever hear that here. I mean, rarely will you hear that. And so most people don't know it, and most economists in this country even don't pay that much attention. But this is not in dispute. And the other part of it that you can't dispute is that it was mostly caused, the majority of that destruction and the lives that it took, and I'm going to mention that in 1 minute, that was caused by the sanctions. And it, you know, and you can look at, this is data from 3 universities who were against the government, so they didn't release it at first. They gave it to the United Nations, and the United Nations released it, so we have the data. And that data showed that in the first year of the Trump sanctions, from 2017 to 18, tens of thousands of people died. It was 40,000 according to the survey data, that the increase in mortality, and it was at least that, most likely because the death rates should have fallen because oil prices were recovering, and again, that's what the economy depends upon. And so that was a huge crime that was committed. And the UN, again, has recognized this as well. You know, under the Geneva Conventions, that is called collective punishment, and it's illegal. Now, the only technicality that it's not actually a war crime is because there was no war going on, although now, you know, there is. And, you know, it is, it could be considered a war crime under various treaties as well. So this is a deadly weapon that the United States has. And it's become in recent years more powerful and more used than the military because they can get away with it, because most people don't know how many people they're killing. And I'll just add one more thing, because it's such a huge thing now, these sanctions, that just, you know, my colleagues and I, Francisco Rodriguez and Silvia Rendon, and I wrote an article in July, was published by The Lancet Global Health. And we estimated how many people are killed by the unilateral sanctions, which are mostly U.S. Sanctions, each year. And over the last decade, it's been 560,000. That was our estimate, 560,000 people each year. And that's as a result of sanctions. And it's also about the same as how many die from armed conflict worldwide.
Mark, I assume that number is not just Venezuela, but the deployment of that tactic of sanctions around the world.
That's right. This is all the countries that are under that was the unilateral sanctions around the world. But it's huge. I mean, it's like armed conflict. So it's a giant weapon that is used by the United States. And you've had people like, you know, like Jim McGovern, who was chair of the House Rules Committee when he wrote this letter to Biden saying, you know, you got to get rid of these sanctions against Venezuela because it's killing people. And he basically showed in his letter too, he said it, and everybody knows it, that it's targeting the civilian population. And that's kind of what Rubio is saying when he says we have this leverage against Venezuela. That's the leverage. It's not against the government so much as it's against the population of the country. And that is, as McGovern said, and many other people, and the UN has said, that is how sanctions actually work. And that's why they're really illegal.
So given what you said a moment ago, that the blockade itself now is in the context of military aggression against Venezuela, as, of course, was the attack on Venezuela that led to the abduction of Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. Given then these acts of war, can you just remind our listeners what the War Powers Act was and is and its relevance right now?
Yes, well, that's another great question, because that gets to what, you know, anybody in the United States can do about this. And fortunately, we have members of Congress, especially the Progressive Caucus in the House, but we have senators now, too. And there's been four of these War Powers resolutions, five actually now, introduced since October 8th, I think it was. And this is the Congress using the 1973 legislation that has the same name, so it gets confusing. That is called the War Powers Resolution. But the legislation that they introduced to use it is also called a War Powers Resolution. So but this is something that Congress legislated in 1973, and it kind of makes it clear what the Constitution says, that the Congress has the power to decide whether the U.S. military can participate in hostilities and armed conflict. And so this is an act that says that, and it provides methods for the Congress to assert this power, which they've always had, but this makes it procedurally a little better. So, for example, a member of Congress can introduce it, and it's not as easily squashed by the leadership. It's they have a privileged introduction of it. And so you have these bills. And why are they important? Because, you know, everybody thinks, well, Trump doesn't care about the rule of law, and he vetoed the one that was passed by both houses for the first time, actually, in 2019. Both houses passed a resolution saying that the U.S. had to cease its participation in the war in Yemen, which had already killed tens of thousands of people at the time that it was introduced. This resolution was introduced. So Trump vetoed it, and so people think, you know, and he doesn't care about the rule of law, like what he just did. We went through with the abduction of a head of state, which the whole world, you know, thinks is atrocious. And so, but the thing is, it really does work to a certain degree, because Congress has political power. And so Trump may not respect the rule of law, but he and his crew really do worry about Congress. Now, why is that? And that's a really important part of this whole problem and trying to resolve it. It's because Congress, they have to worry about if things go bad, which they do in most of our regime change wars and other wars that, you know, don't have anything to do with U.S. national security or anything, which is, you know, almost every war that I've lived through. And so the president and his allies like Rubio have to worry that they're going to get blamed for something that goes wrong. And if the Congress is already coming out against it before it happens, that's really bad for them, because that means that they're much more likely to get blamed for any terrible things that happen as a result of the military actions that they're participating in. So that's extremely important. And that's why you see, first of all, in 2019, to take that one, the successful act, you know, even though Trump ended up vetoing it, he actually, the Pentagon stopped aerial refueling, mid-air refueling of Saudi planes when they were bombing Yemen and killing all these people. And they killed more people, really, in the tens of thousands from the famine that they created there. Again, this is kind of a sanctions thing, right? They cut off the main port, Hodeidah, where most of the food and comes in, and everything they need for water as well, and or most of everything. And so a lot of people were dying. And so because of this thing, he did it before this thing passed. Okay, before this War Powers Resolution passed, they cut that off, and that led to a de-escalation of the war, which also saved more lives. So this is important. And how do we know it's still important now? because we can see what the administration is doing. There's a lot of fierce rhetoric, you can see, and they blew up, killed all these people in boats for, you know, completely false reasons. You know, fentanyl they talk about doesn't even come from South America. But they still are worried about the War Powers Resolution because I think it was November 5th. Rubio and Hegseth and the White House counsel went to the Senate and had a private, it was classified, nobody knew about it when it was happening, but the press, CNN reported on it, and you can see what they did. They went and they said to the senators, don't vote for this War Powers Resolution that's coming to a vote tomorrow, and it's a procedural vote, so this vote is not the one that's going to pass it, but it's going to allow it to get to the floor for a vote that will that can approve it. And they argued with them not to support it, and they made promises. They said, we're not going to have land strikes in Venezuela. We're not going to have war in Venezuela. And the White House counsel even told them, according to the press reports from people who were there, they even told them that they didn't have a legal justification for doing this. And so you can see they were, that shows how worried they were about this vote. And so they succeeded on that one. That was the last one before the one we had on Thursday. And so they succeeded on that vote, and it was only by 2 votes. So again, this is how much they really do worry about this. And this is the main weapon that we have. And I'll add just one last thing on this. The fact that the blockade that they're doing in Venezuela, which is going to, you know, people are going to be starving from that pretty soon if they're not already, because they're cutting off the source of foreign exchange. If that continues, you know, that's going to get worse. And so the blockade itself, according to the UN, is illegal armed conflict. And so this is a way that Congress is, by approving this War Powers Resolution to go to the floor, and it's supposed to be voted on soon, you know, the final vote to see whether it's approved, because 5 Republicans, you know, supported this time for the first time since October. That's going to be Congress really weighing in on the sanctions as they haven't done before.
Economist Mark Weisbrot is my guest. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So, Mark, Trump has been very forthright about his intentions to take control of Venezuela's oil industry and to open it up to U.S. oil companies. Yet, this seems a mixed blessing for oil companies, since the price of oil on the international market is low right now, and Venezuela's crude oil is dense and harder to process. What do you make of the designs of the U.S. government on the oil? Can this attack on Venezuela be framed simply as an act of aggression for oil, or is that too narrow?
Well, that's a complicated question, because Trump is really interested in oil. I mean, look, I'm really cautious about speculating about the motives of anybody, because we don't know what's in their minds. And Trump, of course, is even worse, because he changes his mind from one day to the next more than any president we could probably find in the world. But I think Trump, you know, has, let's just say, it seems like Trump seems to be really interested in the oil. And you can see this in a lot of the press reports that have talked to people in the administration, and they've reported on the kind of back and forth between Rubio and Trump, because Trump wants the oil, and Rubio is a very strong neoconservative from Florida, Cuban American, and really wants to. His lifelong dream, as they reported in the New York Times, you know, seems to be to get rid of the government of Cuba. And he sees getting rid of the government of Venezuela as the as a step towards that. So he's going for both, but Cuba is the main thing. And you could see him, so he wasn't always winning, I mean, because Trump wanted to get the oil. And so he was trying to negotiate, for example, with Chevron, who's been there 100 years and, you know, has been still exporting oil to the United States, or still all the way to the end of the last year. And so Trump wanted to do to expand this kind of commerce, oil, with you know, more oil companies, or at least Chevron. And Rubio would push back, and he would push, and he would. It seemed like he was telling Trump, again, this is a bit speculative, but it seemed like he was saying that the way to get the oil, if that's your main priority, is to get regime change. And of course, Trump didn't really go for the full regime change, because that could very likely have ended in a real war, where they would end up with troops and getting killed, and he's trying to avoid that. Because, you know, he's got no excuse for any of this either, right? I mean, what is, you know, it's so like 19th century, we're going to take your oil. And, I mean, you know, it's, for those of us who talk about this stuff, one of my colleagues said this the other day on the air, you know, that we're used to having to refute these arguments that the United States is fighting for democracy or something like that. And, you know, there's nothing there with Trump. He doesn't even try to say it has anything to do with, you know, we want the oil. And, you know, he says ridiculous things about it, how it's our oil, which has no basis in history. So that's why the answer is a little complicated, because it's a mixture of their two motives, which are somewhat conflicting. But it really, you know, if you look at the last, the whole 21st century, you know, the United States has been trying to get rid of not only the Venezuelan government, but, you know, at least, I don't know, eight other governments that they were just left of center and independent in their foreign policy, which is the main crime. And so, but Venezuela has been the major, the most important target of regime change since really 2002, or even before that.
Well, I definitely want to talk to you about that history, and also more broadly the way the U.S. has tried to destabilize, undermine, and overthrow other governments in the region that are seen as being left of center. But I wanted to ask you if you have a sense of how the oil companies in the United States are viewing this entanglement with Venezuela. Do you think that the oil companies are pushing for this? I mean, putting aside what you're saying about the difficulty in trying to parse out actually what Trump thinks, and that may vary from day to day, and then, as we'll return to, different orientation than his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. But what about the U.S. oil companies themselves? Do we have a sense of how they're viewing all of this?
I can't really say that I have a lot of inside information on that. I think it's kind of mixed. I think they would like to make some money there. I mean, Chevron, for sure. You know, like I said, they've always been able to get along with the government. And, you know, this is something that I think a lot of people have misunderstood in the last 25 years. They've always thought that, and I don't blame them, because, you know, Venezuela is sitting on the largest oil reserves in the world, you know, 300 billion barrels of oil. And that's, by the way, you know, why they never would have gotten so destroyed by the by any kind of recession or depression, because they could always borrow against that, except the sanctions cut them off. So that is how they destroyed the economy, right? And they also created hyperinflation. But the question about what the oil companies think, I think they, you know, there's oil that can be produced within a reasonable amount of time. And of course, Chevron will do what they can, and others, some others might as well. And then there's others that will take more investment. You know, the whole thing is kind of ironic, because, as I was saying, people always thought that we're trying to get oil before. But really, the main goal of regime change for the 21st century, and it included all the presidents that we've had, was really because Venezuela had power as an oil producer. At one point, they were giving more foreign aid to Latin America than the United States, with an economy just a fraction of the size. You had all these countries that had left governments. It was the majority of the region governed by left governments. And so they created organizations like the CELAC, which was basically like the Organization of American States, only without the U.S. and Canada, so that they could make decisions and talk, at least, without having the United States there, which was always trying to get rid of their, their governments. And they, Venezuela created Petrocaribe, and to help other countries with oil. And then there was UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations. And, I was part of a commission of UNASUR, and that was all of South America at that time in 2016, that it was a commission of economists that UNASUR sent to Venezuela to try and figure out how they could revive their economy when, oil prices had fallen and they had they already had sanctions, not the broad economic sanctions, but they had sanctions that were hurting them. It started under Obama in 2015. And so, again, they did all these things that were cooperative and were building a new regional force in the hemisphere, which wasn't radical or anything. It was just to preserve their self-determination against a government, a whole series of governments that really didn't respect their right to choose their own governments. So that's what really most of the regime change was about. It wasn't really about oil. And, and you could see that, Chevron, of course, wanted to leave Chavez alone. Exxon, for at least, I think, 7 years, was in the same camp. They were making money. And so, yeah, that's what's the deep irony here, because here's Trump acting as though he's got to force Venezuela to cough up the oil. But they've been more than willing for many years to have more U.S. investment and oil company investment there and take their cut. And they just couldn't do it because of the sanctions.
What you've been laying out is that there has been a bipartisan effort, Democrats and Republicans over multiple U.S. administrations, trying to undermine the Venezuelan government. But in this most recent incarnation that we're seeing right now, with Trump at the helm, but Marco Rubio as Secretary of State, you were saying that there are these sort of twinned visions, if we can call them that. On the one side, whatever Trump thinks, and oil seems very central to that. And then Marco Rubio, who is more concerned with power and regime change. What do you think Marco Rubio's vision, if we can call it that, is for the Americas?
Oh, it's pretty dismal. I mean, first of all, he wants real regime change in Cuba and Venezuela, and he's very unlikely to get that without violence. And he doesn't care, I don't think he worries about, he cares, he has to care because, Trump cares, was worried about his presidency. But I think that's part of it. But it's more than that, because, there's other left governments that they want to get rid of. And, Brazil is one of them, too. By the way, and that's for sure, he would want to get rid of Brazil, the Brazilian government, the Mexican government, and they've intervened in all of these countries. In Brazil, Lula's even said this on TV. It's quite obvious that by actions that the various administrations took, including the Obama administration, against first Lula.
Of the left-leaning Workers' Party.
Yeah. And for the impeachment of Dilma, they supported that, and they made it clear that they supported that by things they did in public. In 2018, what Lula says is, and it's pretty clearly true, is that they helped, and he names the FBI and the Justice Department, they helped put him in jail so he couldn't run for president. He left office with 87% approval rating. He would have won that 2018 election, and you'd have a different story in Latin America right now, too. And so, again, I could go through more of the regime change efforts that they've had, of the ways in which they've tried to get rid of government. This is Rubio's, what Rubio wants. In 2019, There was a military coup in Bolivia, and the U.S. played a huge role in that through the Organization of American States, and they basically helped put forth this plan or this idea that which the OAS supported right after, immediately after the election. It was completely false. I mean, it was arithmetically, it was shown to be false. You didn't even need the statistical analysis, which we did a bunch of them anyway, because there are other some other economists tried to use them. But basically, the election was fair, and you know, it just there was a change in the you know, the last 16% of votes came in more pro-Evo, because they came in from more pro-Evo Morales areas. That was all that simple, something you can see on CNN elections all the time. And they tried to say that was evidence of a stolen election, and the military intervened and forced him out of the country, the first indigenous president of a majority indigenous country, and someone who was very successful, by the way, you know, in economic terms, in land reform and pensions, and you know, so this is the kind of thing that they did. And they intervened in other countries as well, you know, three times since 1991 in Haiti, with and this shows that it isn't about necessarily even the resources, because Haiti didn't have anything, but they see an opportunity. It's like a chess game to them, right? It's and Haiti is a pawn, and when they can take it, you know, they elected their first democratic election they had in 1991, and so and it was a president who wanted to change things and make it better, and they got rid of him. The CIA was involved in that coup, and then they got rid of him again because Clinton was forced by the Congressional Blackhawks to put him back. The Black Caucus in Congress forced Clinton. They told him that they weren't going to support his health care reform if he didn't put Aristide back. So we had, the first time we had someone that the United States overthrew was put back by a U.S. military force in 1994. But then he was overthrown again by the Bush administration in 2004. They put him on a rendition plane and took him to Africa. And so these are just, I mean, that's just a one third of the regime change efforts that I could go through. Argentina, they've always been undermining the government of Argentina. You know, that's another story that shows both what happened positively in the 21st century, you know. Argentina returned to growth with the Kirchner governments in starting in 2003. They drastically reduced poverty and extreme poverty after the IMF had a depression right before that, from 1998 to 2002. And so you had this thing, and then all the while since then, you know, the United States has been trying to undermine the government. And the real kicker was in 2012, when a New York court ruled that Argentina could not pay its creditors, bondholders that it was paying, okay, like 80 or 90% of them, they couldn't pay them. And that is, you know, that is why we ended up all with, you know, if you want to follow the whole story through, you know, that is, I think, one of the main reasons that we ended up with Milei.
The right-wing head of Argentina now.
Yeah. Which, of course, the United States intervened in that election as well, by getting him, you know, tens of billions of dollars. And again, you can go through more of them. Ecuador has a right-wing government that's strongly supported by the United States right now. And so this is Rubio, this is the short answer to what Rubio's goals are. He wants that. Trump, I don't think, cares about that, really. So he's not necessarily going to want to take the same risk, and he's going to move in some different directions. Like right now, they are, and you know, I don't know that they'll stick to this, but they are proposing to eliminate some sanctions in order to allow for the export of oil. But it's not that clear, how they're going to do that. They'll still have their blockade, and they're also trying to tell the Venezuelan government right now that you can't export oil to Cuba. So they're still going to have, so it looks like they're going to keep the blockade. So this is going to cause problems if they're really trying to get rid of at least a significant part of the sanctions. That's going to be a problem, but it is something that I think would worry Rubio quite a bit, because again, he's going for a regime change in both countries, and so the control over Venezuela's oil is extremely important to him.
I'm speaking with economist Mark Weisbrot. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So, Mark, you were enumerating the many, many attempts that the US government has made in the 21st century, and of course, long before that, to destabilize or overthrow governments in the Americas. And I wonder if you could place those attempts, kind of step back historically and just remind listeners how a series of left-leaning governments, basically social democratic governments, came to power in the region. You've mentioned a whole number of them, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Lula in Brazil, but how that shift in the political winds in Latin America was taken to be a significant threat to the United States, at least from the view of the US government.
Well, this is another great question because, it does reflect badly, I think, on a lot of the people who write and discuss and act in politics in this country. Because if you think of what happened, okay, in that, in all these countries where you had left governments, look at Latin America, what happened to Latin America from 2002 to 2013. They reduced poverty from 44 to 28%. Now that comes after a whole 2 decades, 20 years, from 1980 to 2000, where there was no poverty reduction at all, and very little growth. The Latin American economy grew about maybe 7% total, not annually. Per capita income grew by about 7% from 80 to 2000. It was the worst economic failure in a century. And of course, from 60 to 80, it grew by 90%. It almost doubled. And this is a huge difference because they could have kept growing like this. There was nothing in the world that would have prevented that, and in fact, they should have grown at least as fast because there was better technology available, and there were all kinds of opportunities that didn't exist prior. So imagine the difference between, countries like Brazil grew like 147% per capita, like South Korea. And South Korea, of course, went on and has European living standards today. Well, these countries could have had European living standards as well. And this was an intervention by the United States. It was more in terms of the IMF and the so-called multilateral institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and other forces, and they used the big debt that Latin America had to change economic policy. I mean, I can't say it was all them, right? Because people did get to vote and elect their leaders, but they didn't have enough democracy, really, and independence to resist this huge neoliberal change that really was more than anything made in Washington, but also applied throughout the region. So imagine that difference. So what happened in 2000 when the left gets all these governments, Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, Ecuador, Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia? Well, they did extremely well, and they didn't get to the 60 to 80 level, but they got a good part of the way there in terms of their economic growth. As I said, they reduced poverty. And they became independent in a in really important ways, and they were, I mean, I can even use Venezuela as an example. I mean, under Chavez, they because he's always demonized here too, but they tripled the number of people who went to college. They tripled the people with pensions who were over 60. They grew at a very good pace. Incomes grew. It was probably the biggest rise in living standards and reduction in poverty that they ever had, in terms of what was accomplished during that time. And and they had democratic elections, by the way, under Chavez. In fact, Jimmy Carter said in 2012 that of the 92 elections that the Carter Center was had monitored, he said the election process in Venezuela is the best in the world. And if you knew the process of that elections, you can see why you can't really steal them, because you have a dual copy. You press a button, on a screen, and then that's your electronic vote, and then you get a printout and you put it in a ballot box. And under Chavez, at least, they had democratic elections, and the vote count was verified and observed by international observers, and they were clean. It was really a positive. It was real progress in the region, both politically and economically. And then, yeah, as you said, almost all of these governments, almost all of them, were demonized here, or were seen badly and punished by the United States. And you think, this is probably the first time in history that you had this type of change for this many people happening at the ballot box. And you would think that anybody who's, liberal or left of center would see this as a great historic step forward and want to make sure that it continued. But instead, they didn't.
Mark, you mentioned the election of Javier Milei in Argentina and how the US ironically subsidized his right-wing libertarian presidency. How important has the US been for the ascendancy of right-wing governments elsewhere, including the recent election of Pinochet supporting President-elect Kast and the right-wing president-elect in Honduras?
Honduras, they definitely intervened, as they did in 2009. They supported the military coup there, and that was another example of a government that was, social democratic, reduced poverty, raised the minimum wage. That was trying to change, the government wanted a new constitution because theirs was from the dictatorship, and the U.S. Supported this military coup to get rid of him. And so the country's had trouble ever since. This is the real problem too, that people think, oh, they have a coup, it can be reversed, and but it causes permanent damage sometimes. So yeah, so this last election, I won't go through the details of it, but I think that the main result is that it was extremely close between the two right-wing candidates, and Trump picked the one that was farther to the right. The point is that he picked who would win, and that election it was extremely close. We don't really know who won. It was that close. But so Trump really made the difference, because he said out loud, he told the country that it had to be Nasfura. If his candidate didn't win, from the National Party, that Honduras would be in trouble, and they wouldn't get money. And when you see a country pretty close to you be destroyed by the United States, that's the other way that the sanctions really work. They really intimidate people. And Trump said it out loud, but other presidents have done similar things. And so, yeah, there wasn't much of a, I mean, in many ways, it was a limited contest, because both of those parties, the National and the Liberal Party, supported the 2019 coup. But the point is that Trump was able to determine the winner. So no democratic election there either.
How serious do you think we should take the threats that Trump has made to, well, multiple countries at this point, including after the US's attack on Venezuela, Colombia, Cuba, which you mentioned that Marco Rubio would love to see overthrown, but also Mexico, and not to mention, of course, countries outside of the hemisphere, Greenland and Iran?
Yeah, it's very hard to say. What makes this so difficult is that, of course, Trump, most of what he's done in the last 10 years for both campaigning and for governing has a huge emphasis on distraction. And so a lot of these things, that's a big part of the motivation. This whole buildup in the Caribbean and the bombing of small boats. For no proven reason. It gave him a whole theater of operation to create all kinds of distractions. And so it's very hard to predict what he would do. You can see he flips too. Like he says he's going to meet with President Petro not long after saying that Petro should watch his ass and that he might bomb Colombia. So, anything he says one day, now he says it's a great honor to have him at the White House. So, it's very hard to predict what he will do. I think with Rubio, he's going to follow the kind of undermining of left governments by whatever they can feel they can get away with. That part, I think, and that's been consistent. See, that's the thing, Rubio has. That's been consistent with the whole 21st century, and of course, long before that. But also, Rubio has a lot of allies in this so-called national security state, the 18 intelligence agencies, the Pentagon, State Department, the foreign policy committees of Congress. And so that's a big thing that Trump can't even really control, but he doesn't care to very much anyway, as long as he gets the things that he wants, which are mostly just about him. He was very happy with this military operation and he bragged about it and he looked tough. And that's the kind of stuff that he likes. And the oil, yeah, I think he has goals there, but I can't say exactly. He is a president that has enriched himself more than anyone in U.S. history and a great deal of world history as well. Through his presidency. So there could be some money there too.
Mark Weisbrot, let me end by asking you about how you see Trump in light of the Monroe Doctrine, which he has referred to, refashioning it in his own name as the Donroe Doctrine, the Monroe Doctrine, which, in the 19th century asserted the right of the US to have power over the Americas, excluding other great powers. Do you see that what Trump seems to be doing, or Trump and Rubio seem to be doing, or their intentions anyway, are simply in line with a longer history? Is there something coherent that could be captured as the Donroe Doctrine, or is this just a kind of more recent incarnation of something that has run through US history?
I think it's mostly a recent incarnation of what we've seen even in recent history, but it's more, it's all about saying the quiet part out loud, I mean, Hillary Clinton wrote in her memoirs that she helped make sure that the democratically elected president, of Honduras couldn't get back to the presidency. And but she took it out of the next edition of her book. And I, people, they don't say these kinds of things that Trump would say. This is really it's more aggressively threatening, and we'll see if it's more yeah, it's definitely more violent. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, sending bombing these boats, these are things. But in terms of overall damage, it's still up in the air. I mean, think of the sanctions that killed at least 40,000 and probably over 100,000 people in Venezuela. That's violence too. What makes them different is really the violence on display. People like Hegseth and Trump, they seem to, the way he says we killed the Cubans, or these people are dead, like dead, that was Trump. And they say these things that kind of try to almost glorify the violence. So that's a different aspect to it. And of course, yeah, the open plunder of resources is a little different than what you've had in recent decades, that's for sure.
Mark Weisbrot, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Mark Weisbrot is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's the author of Failed: What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. He's been writing about Venezuela for 25 years. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast.